Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
And then that's why I'm voting for it.
That's right. That's right. Everyone's going to be like, what the heck did we say? We just missed that. Cold cut. Sean, so I mentioned we're talking mainly for Forbes, and we're going to take this audio, put it out as a cast as well. And I want everyone who's, you know, listening and stuff to know that this is kind of interesting. I mean, I was just decided I'm going to watch a documentary while I'm on my treadmill. And so I choose, brand new, recommended for me, Netflix versus the World on Amazon Prime, which, reading from IMDb, the story of how a tiny, broke Silicon Valley startup slew giants of the movie rental world, warded off Amazon, and forced movie making and distribution into the digital age. And I was blown away by it. And I mean, they're like, who made this thing? And then I said, who's Sean Coffin? And I want to make sure I don't forget. So I first learned a little bit about you from your website, texasmoviedirector.com. I then started stalking you on Twitter, where your handle is Dude Versus Movie, and that's Dude VS Movie. And I reached out and said, hey, man, I'm a fan from a couple of angles, the Netflix story, but also what it's like to be an indie movie maker these days. Do you want to talk? And you were nice enough to say yes. So welcome to the cast. Thanks for chatting for Forbes.
Thanks for having me. No, I mean, when you reached out, like, I've actually used Twitter to reach out to people that have watched the movie. So it's interesting to talk to people from like South Africa or Vancouver or across the pond in England, because, you know, as a, you know, independent movie maker here in Austin, Texas, outside of Hollywood, it's cool to have your work seen around the world, especially when it was a tough hill to climb, so to speak, to get the film made.
Well, we'll get more into that in a second. But so how'd you get into the movie making business? What's your background? You look like a pretty young guy. So to have something like, you know, out there like this seems pretty cool.
My camera must be doing good things for me, because I'm 37. I have four children, and they definitely make me look tired all the time. I went to college here in Austin at University of Texas to become the next, you know, McConaughey. I'm a Texan, so I went to the University of Texas to get a film degree, and then when I graduated, I worked on a few independent films here in Austin, and then I started working for MTV on a show called Room Raiders. So basically, someone would go through three different rooms, and based on that, they would decide who they went on a date with. So that show ended up getting canceled, but I moved out to LA, and I did celebrity interviews and red carpets for a platform called Canal Plus, which is a European station. Okay. And I worked for the Spanish version of that. And so I was out there in Hollywood for a bit. And then most people in LA will attest to this. Like, you're not going to own a house in LA unless, like, you're like a millionaire. You're right. Hitting it big. So we decided, although I loved LA and I loved what I did out in LA, I wanted to move back to Texas so I could actually own a house. And so I ended up back out here. But I always had the desire to kind of make movies. And like I said before, having four children, young girls, I'm a dad of girls, and my wife having a successful career herself, documentary is what you could do, because you could go fly somewhere for a weekend and fly home to be with the family. Yeah. And everything. So that's what I did. And the first movie I worked on, there was a couple guys making trying to raise money to make a documentary about Nickelodeon. And I grew up in that Nickelodeon, like, I was a Nickelodeon kid. Like, I didn't have the Disney Channel growing up. I had Nickelodeon. So it was definitely something that I was like, well, I'm used to interviewing celebrities and such like that. So I can jump onto this project and help them, because interviewing people for movies like Tom Cruise and Will Smith and everything, I knew the Nickelodeon people weren't going to be above that level. So I was already used to working with high profile talent. So I came on there. I helped shoot, I helped edit, and I helped produce. And then at the end of that, I was looking on the next project I wanted to do. And there was a book. And I don't read a lot because I'm always jumping from show to show or working on different stuff or spending time with my family. But I read this book that was called Netflix, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs, which Gina Keating wrote. And it was about Netflix and their origin. I was like, that would be a great documentary. So I reached out to her and I was like, hey, I'm starting my next documentary. I would love to interview you. And she said, well, I've actually started my own documentary. Maybe we should team up. And so that's how the movie kind of started.
And I want to make sure for people who aren't familiar with it. So the other project you talked about, it became what's called the Orange Years, the Nickelodeon story. So this fascinates me. I want to talk a little bit about Netflix and then go back to sort of the process involved. You picked up that book, said, okay, I'm not an avid reader, but you picked up that book because you're in the business. You're kind of curious about it, right?
Right.
And what is it about you? Like, I'm sure a lot of people pick up books and read it. Not a lot of people are like, yeah, I'm the guy that could make a movie about this. Now, you've got the movie-making background, but I would think a lot of people would want to make a movie out of this. Didn't cross your mind like, well, someone else already doing it, or I could never be the guy. Like, you just thought, sure, I'll make this movie.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I was like, I looked, no one had made it. I was like, this is the Apple of our generation. This is that story of that underdog company that shouldn't have succeeded yet did. And it's even like when the books was written, it's even changed. I mean, you think about Netflix's change how we consume content.
Yeah.
That's huge. I mean, how many companies, specific companies, can you point to and say that company changed how people live their lives?
Yeah.
And that's what I saw with Netflix. And it was weird because I would tell people the story and they're like, yeah, it's interesting, but like why make it? Or yeah, Netflix isn't going to let you make this and stuff like that. And I'm like, well, they can't really stop me. So yeah, I'll make it. I'll see what happens. And if it doesn't go anywhere, like at least I gave it a go.
And for people who haven't read the book or seen the documentary yet, tell them a little bit about the early years of Netflix, you know, how they got their start.
Yeah. So Netflix, like most tech stories, starts out in, you know, Silicon Valley. And basically what it was is, I don't know if people remember, but in the 90s, there was things called video stores, right? Where you would go and rent. And I have my shirt here because I remember being a little boy and I had a local like mom and pop like video store. And I remember Blockbuster coming in and I would go to my local store and be like, guys, I'm a kid. And I'm like, no, I'm staying here. Like you are where I come to get my movies. And of course I ended up going to Blockbuster because they had all the, you know, the 12 cases of right. The new, you know, Men in Black or whatever was out at the time. So Netflix, when they were kind of starting, it was kind of looking at places that they could disrupt, something that wasn't really operating at a peak performance that they could do using the internet. And it's weird to think because the internet started, what, late 70s, but that was more for universities and more with government-based stuff. So even in the 90s, like I had the internet to play like Call of Duty or something like that. Like it wasn't what it is now. So by the process of elimination, a guy named Mark Randolph and Reed Hastings would kind of throw ideas back and forth. So they had this idea to ship movies to your home that you would go online, rent online, and they would mail it to you. The only thing is, at this time, it was about VHSs. And for the younger viewers, VHSs are kind of like these like plastic black things that are a lot smaller than DVDs, which you might not even know what a DVD is. So we've progressed so far. So there was a lot of things that had to happen for Netflix for it to succeed, because if they had started when it was VHS, it would have never worked. And that's why they abandoned the idea. But the invention of the DVD allowed this idea to kind of percolate and go forward.
And the for the listeners out there and my entrepreneurial minded folks, you know, followers, you know, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, Netflix was not founded by like movie lovers or movie fans, or it was two guys, you know, Reed and Mark, you talk about them, were basically looking just like, what's a idea that's going to make money? Like, what's a disruptive area? They were very opportunistic about it, and they tried all kinds of things that didn't work. And as you described, this big, bulky, heavy-ish VHS tape would have cost a lot to send in the mail, you know, it was a mail order thing, or would have gotten smashed. And the story that, you know, you tell in the movies that they basically, once CDs come out, DVDs come out, then it's a disc, they just buy one, go to a store and buy an envelope, drop it in, walk to the post office next door, mail it to their own house, and it arrives unbroken, and they're like, oh, okay, this will work. And that's how they got into it, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much luck that goes into it. I mean, you had to think they had to be in the process of always thinking and trying to figure out like how they ideate, like what could work, and not afraid to come up with a crazy idea and then throw it out if it wasn't working. But they also had to have the luck, which Mark Randolph says is they mailed the CD to Reed's house in the same city. So that just goes from the mailbox into a thing for a local delivery and out. Now, if they would have shipped it to a different city, it would have went to a processing plant where the disc would have been destroyed, and they would have said, well, that's not going to work because, look, it's destroyed, so we can't send DVDs. Let's go and think of a different type of company. So it's having that great idea, but also there's a little luck that comes into it.
I'm glad you brought that up because that did stick out to me. One, like, it was lucky that they did a local shipping, but also – two really smart guys, it's shocking that they didn't think, like, we better do this test mailer from coast to coast because I bet that's a different process than the one in our town. And they never thought that. It's like, really?
And the great thing is when they did come into the thing of testing it and saying, oh, dear Lord, it's going to be destroyed, they figured out how to fix it. It wasn't like, okay, we got to scrap everything. They're like, okay, now we've come into a problem that we didn't foresee. How do we solve said problem instead of like, all right, let's just abandon it and move on. It's that focus of figuring out what the issue is and how to overcome it versus like just having multiple plate spinning and then just jumping to another plate because that one has an issue with it.
Yeah. And along that line, like what comes through in the documentary is, I mean, today Netflix just seems like success, like a giant, like they're just awesome. The documentary sort of shows it almost feels like they're failing over and over and over again as they continue to grow. And there's even a kind of iconic moment where they're getting so beat up by Blockbuster, they go and meet with Blockbuster to talk about maybe selling out to them. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So this is actually one of the drives I had to make the movie because, I mean, you don't have to be in the business world or the tech world to have heard the story about Blockbuster passing on buying Netflix. And everyone looks back, you know, of course, with hindsight, you're like, oh, what an idiot. They didn't spend $50 million to buy Blockbuster. But if you look at the context of what was happening in the world, like all your dot-coms were going broke, like anything with a dot-com all of a sudden where once was sexy was now like, because Netflix's name used to be Netflix.com. They eventually dropped the .com when all of a sudden .com was kind of like a bad sign to have in your company name. So you're going to Netflix, you're going to Blockbuster, and you're pitching your company that you say you want $50 million for to a company that makes billions of dollars, because at this time, Blockbuster was still bringing in billions of dollars of money. Unfortunately, it was for Viacom and not for themselves. But so you put yourself in that context and you're like, you're a multi-billion dollar company. And here comes this little upstart that you think if you wanted to, you could do the same thing because you have those contacts with the studios. You can get those DVDs at a cheaper cost than Netflix can because they don't have your relationship. All you'd have to figure out is this, the distribution system if you wanted. So, you know, 99 out of 100 people are going to pass. So that was a great thing to go back and kind of figure out of like what is considered one of the greatest like blunders in business history. It's really not that much of a blunder when you go back and you put yourself into that same place. If you were the CEO or if you were part of acquisitions, like knowing your job is on the line, would you drop like a $50K on this like upstart California company that you truly think you could do by yourself if you wanted to?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I found that was a really great insight on kind of taking something that everyone holds true and kind of like putting a different light on it. So that's one of the coolest aspects about the doc, I think.
And just playing off that story, but back to the theme of good luck, bad luck, whatever. Blockbuster did end up launching like a separate Skunks Works division to take them on directly. I forget what they called their service at the time, but
it was Blockbuster Online, and then it became Blockbuster. I'll have to go back.
Yeah, I know. It had some weird. They kind of changed the name, and they actually ended up. They did successfully compete against them, and they had the wrinkle of like you could bring the discs back to the local.
It became Blockbuster Total Access. It
Total went
from Access.
Blockbuster
Online to Total Access.
That's it. Blockbuster Total Access. Yeah. So then you could go. So they had a little advantage, and it looked like Blockbuster. You know, they had decided we're not going to buy you. We're going to compete. It took them a little while to figure it out, but it looked like they were gonna do it. They're gonna win. But then Blockbuster had an internal, like a hostile investor. They had their own drama, and they just sort of changed their mind and they pulled back from that. Can you tell a little bit about Blockbuster deciding not to continue in the space?
Yeah. So the biggest issue with Blockbuster was their brick and mortar. So they were competing against Netflix. I mean, there was other people at the time. The time of a documentary doesn't allow us to jump into Redbox and what was going on with Hollywood Video going under and all those other aspects. But basically where Netflix could be nimble and be very focused on streaming, Blockbuster couldn't just concentrate on delivering DVDs. It was about the people that had franchises. Mm-hmm. They had to make the franchisees happy who had brick and mortar stores and saw the online business as competition, rightly so, that would put them out of business. And basically they couldn't have the corporation that they were paying a franchise fee to undercutting them. So that was some of the stuff that Blockbuster had to fight against. And also you had Carl Icahn. So if you know anything about Carl Icahn, the dude makes a lot of money, but he makes the money from picking from the bones of bigger corporations. So he'll just come in and then start selling off the parts of these bigger corporations, and he'll make a killing. But basically, he kills that corporation. And so that's what happened to Blockbuster. And some of the stories that we couldn't even tell just because of timing is just one story I was told is – One of the guys that Carl brought in, he had a genius idea of selling worms.
Worms.
So if you were gonna go fishing, you could stop at your Blockbuster. Not only could you rent a movie, you could buy worms for fishing. So it's like that was some of the intellectual think that was going in from, you know, the board that was run by Carl, and then the guys at Blockbuster that are like, are you effing kidding me? You want us to bring worms? Like, exactly. Here's your Tom Cruise movie, and here is, like, bait? Like, so there was a lot of internal struggle that just made it not possible for Blockbuster to overcome the brick-and-mortar issues that they had.
Yeah, and again, with the business lens, it's just so many fascinating lessons about, you know, just because – there's an 800-pound gorilla and it's not you, they have other internal battles going on that you might not even know about. They've got other constituents that you don't have to worry about. They have things like maybe mountains of debt that they need to be worrying about. And so, again, like the reason why Netflix and a lot of startup stories, it's so compelling is it really is this David versus Goliath thing where – like at every turn, at every chapter, it's like, okay, they should not survive to the next chapter, to the next step. And yet they do. And I'm curious, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, you know, this didn't get the official cooperation of Netflix. You don't have Reed Hastings, you know, telling these stories. But you do have the co-founder and the first CEO who was really the one running it in the early years, Mark Randolph. How hard was it to get him? How'd you get him?
Well, Gina had written the book previously, so she had all those contacts. So it actually made it opening up. And, I mean, if people go back to look at the Apple story, you think about all the people that kind of put in the work to build Apple to where it was. Steve Jobs became the superstar, right? So, and everyone kind of started forgetting about the founding team. Same thing at Netflix. Like, a lot of people, I mean, I think, well, one, I think a lot of people at Netflix have probably seen the stock now.
Yeah.
Because we had sent a version of it just to get Netflix's approval, and we didn't hear back, but we heard from some people on the inside that it was being passed around. So it was like, that's cool, but also you're passing around a screener that's only supposed to go to one person.
Right.
But it's like a lot of these people were forgotten. They were forgot about the times where Netflix was just an idea with, you know, a starting cap of like Reed put in 1.9 mil and then Mark raised the other 100K. So it started out with about $2 million. Mm-hmm. So those people just, you know, meeting together at like a restaurant to kind of brainstorm and then moving into a Best Western, like small conference center room to kind of operate and then going into an old bank with old carpets and using the vault to hold their DVDs. So it was kind of, it was almost telling that story too. So it's Netflix is who it is and everyone knows Netflix, but it's also telling about the people that put in those hours, those long days of trying to figure out the codes of how you come up with a queue. Like, queues have kind of died now, but at the time they pioneered what a queue was, that you could set up your queue and it would send the next movie to you, and to come up with just the different aspects of, like, you rent something and it stays at your house and you're not paying a late fee, you're just paying a subscription fee, which, you know, everything is subscription, but they're the team that came up with that idea. So,
see, this is so much good stuff, and I feel like we're having to translate for different ages of our audience. And I'm 53, so I'm a lot older than you, but then my kids will listen to this, and they're, you know, going to need, like, what? And as you described, so, like, the queue was an online list. You had to, like, pick, okay, what are the next 10 movies I want to see? And you could always log online and change them. Sometimes the things wouldn't be in stock or whatever it is, so you would have to kind of adjust your list. And that was like a big thing. It was kind of like early playlists or something, you know, just not in real time. And what we take for granted for this subscription revenue, like everything is subscription these days, right? And like, you know, Spotify or whatever, it's just, of course. But Netflix, that was like a breakthrough idea. It's not – you're paying to rent for 2 days and then a late fee, which everyone hated. It's, I'm just going to pay a flat fee per month. And whether I rent two things and hold them for 3 months or keep quickly churning them back, that was up to me. But like, this blew people's minds. Like, people weren't doing that back then.
I mean, we talked about luck coming into play, but this aspect is just genius.
Yes.
I mean, you've changed how commerce works. That's like, how many people have changed how commerce works? It's mind blowing. I mean, just going back on it, like, there was so much great information that I just had to cut. Like, there was like at least 20 minutes movie I had to cut just because, like, fascinating to me, fascinating to business people, but I still try to make a documentary that everyone could watch. But like, they had a thing called Birds and Pigs.
Birds and Pigs.
So your birds were the people that would like rent a movie and it would just hang out with them. Your pigs were people like me that were at the University of Texas, rent a movie. It would arrive. I'd watch it as soon as it arrived. I'd put it back, send it back for them to send me another DVD. So they started delaying that, where I would get my DVDs slower and slower because I was a pig, because I was just using the service as much as I could. Also, if you were a bird, say a new movie came out and we'll put it in. It's so weird because movies are like on pause right now. But let's say you wanted to watch the latest James Bond movie, right? And you're a bird and we're both competing for it. Well, you get that movie and I have to wait because they already know me as a customer. So, you know, I get number 12 on my list to watch. And that's actually, it forced me to watch a lot of European films. I started watching because I couldn't get the new releases. Like Netflix, like it would jump to my queue and I would get like some, you know, Antonio Banderas Spanish movie that he made before he came over to America. So it forced me to watch some things. Or one time I rented a movie and Netflix mistakenly sent me like The Grizzlies of the Yukon. And I was like, what the hell? And I was so mad because I had to ship it back and I knew I had the 3-day shipping back and to come to me. But yeah, that college is a whole different experience.
Did you even bother to watch The Grizzlies of the Yukon?
Hell no, because I don't want to waste the time. I wanted to get it back to Netflix as fast as possible.
The you know, something that comes through in the documentary is you know, Mark Randolph, Reed Hastings sort of start this as the main co-founders. And but Reed replaces Mark as the leader of the company at some point when they go to raise some more money. And this is common in startups that the first founders kind of take a company to a certain level and then they bring in professional management or maybe there's a falling out. One of my favorite movies, The Social Network, is basically this story about two friends who are founders and then have a falling out. Mark in your movie is very gracious about this. Like he doesn't come across as having any, you know, bitterness or animosity. He just said, look, I was running it. Reed's smart. He knew everyone in Silicon Valley. When we had to raise serious money, it was clear he had to be the CEO in order to go raise that money. And it worked out. Like I didn't get a hint that there's any animosity. And yet there was something he said later in the film. He said, oh, when I heard about the Quickster thing, I knew what he was doing. And it made me think, like, he doesn't talk to Reed anymore. Like, he's not tied into that company.
They're actually friends.
They're still in touch. And
yeah, and they'll go out. So they kept that relationship, which – yeah, I mean they're so cool. But yeah, Mark doesn't have any insights on like what's the day to day with Netflix.
Doesn't have any operational role. He's not on the board kind of thing or anything.
Yeah,
like
he's helping with other different startups and you know he's an entrepreneur. He's all about like the creation, the birth of this new thing where Netflix is no longer in the birth. Netflix is a full grown beast. They're Goliath going out there trying to, you know, squash their competition.
When you went, so I'm shifting a little bit more to sort of the business of filmmaking, independent filmmaking. Ballpark, someone wants to go make a documentary about the orange years or Netflix versus the world. What does it cost to make a documentary like this? And where do you get the funding?
It depends. For the orange years, we did crowdfunding, but so much in independent filmmaking, soft cost. Our budget for Netflix First of the World would have been 3 times what it cost us to make because I had access to the cameras. I know how to shoot. My friends came on and shot for a percentage. I edited the whole thing at home on my personal computer with the newborn. And so if I actually paid myself, you know, the person that did the score for this, he took a discount. Like he makes music for God of War and like big time video games and shows for Hulu. And why did he take a discount? Because when I lived in Hollywood, he was our first baseman on our kickball team. So it's relationships. It's finding people. The guy that did our animation for the Orange Years, and I asked him if he'd come on to do this for Netflix First of the World. So when it comes to independent filmmaking, it's about making the movie for what you can. Asking favors. I got funding. Originally, I was going to do a crowdfunding, but then I had my boss and the founder of the company I work for, who are both gracious people that, you know, gave me the money. And did they give me the money because it was a Netflix documentary? No, because they believed in me and they wanted to see me succeed. So it's a thing of But here's the thing. I wouldn't have taken their money if I didn't think I could make it back.
Yeah.
Like, I made the film for what I thought it could be made for as cheaply as I could, but for the best quality I could. But knowing that if people were going to invest with me, my main goal was not to make profit for myself. It was to make sure right. that everyone was made whole. Like the people that came on to work, making sure that they got paid and everything like that, because I have other movies that I'm in the process of making and they're all different styles. Like I'm making a documentary about Otto Frank, which is Anne Frank's father.
Yeah.
Which kind of tells the story about people writing to him after he published his diary. And that's right now is with a sales company in England that's talking to big players. So that's a whole different ballpoint. Then,
so it depends on the type of film, the intended audience, right. all of that, and how you.
Yeah, I'm making a docuseries about the fandom of the show The Office, and that's all self-funded. Like, I haven't raised any cash for it. It's like, what do you have in your pocket? Let's go to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to a baseball game where Leslie David Baker is going to be, who played Stanley, and let's just go interview him, or let's go find. A mechanic in Arizona who saved someone's life using CPR that he learned from watching The Office.
Oh
so I have different style things, and it's just, it's mainly about going out and making it.
How long did it take you, how long did it take you from sort of beginning to, you know, to post, to finish a post on the Netflix one? And this Netflix, wasn't your full-time effort. Like it wasn't like you're putting in 50 hours a week on it. Right. So
it, I'll say this. I put in enough time that it was my wife being understanding and my kids being understanding that, like, you know, daddy, come play with me. And you're like editing and you feel bad because
yeah.
you're wasting, you know, daddy time for movie time. So it's that balance. But Netflix was actually really quick. I think I pitched it to Gina in May of 2018, I want to say, and we were ready to go in 2019. So it was probably
wow.
a year turnaround. And then we'll get into the business side a little bit, is we were talking to different distributors and looking out about what the release plan was going to be, and COVID hit.
Mm.
And then it became a thing of like, all right, do we keep kicking around with different distributors or seeing what deals we could get? Or do we just release it? So we just went the independent route and released it with a company called Indie Rights because everyone was stuck at home. And it's like, if you're going to release a movie on streaming, this is the time. So we kind of just jumped, you know, head first into it. And right now we've had a great response. In the month of September, it was a top five documentary on Amazon Prime, which is a whole different marketing aspect of why you have a Netflix movie on Amazon Prime.
Right. So, in other interviews, I was reading your previous interviews, you talk about like, this is the best time ever to make documentaries.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. Like, here's my phone. This is the new iPhone. And, this camera is amazing. The audio is okay. if I was making a documentary and doing interviews, I would have separate audio, but the camera quality here is so good. And I just got this phone. I used to have just the X. And if I was in a location where I didn't have a camera, I'd pull out my phone and I'd shoot it.
Wow.
And our movie, Netflix versus the World, actually has some camera footage from an iPhone. Like one of the interviews that was done with a marketing like guru was done with a phone because I couldn't get there. And we only had this window for the person. It's like, all right, just shoot it with your phone. We'll put it in because people aren't going to go. I mean, film snobs are going to go and be like, oh, look at that interview, like the frame rate and stuff like that. But the average person isn't going to notice. And it's more about the story.
Right.
So it's just the process of like, if you only have a window to get someone during a certain time, go for it. Now, here's one aspect about it that does make it difficult. It is the best time to go out and make movies, but also that means it's the best time for everyone to go out and make movies. So you have this whole influx of content, and it's how do you get above when it comes to content? If you're releasing a movie on Amazon Prime, you're competing against thousands and thousands of movies, and a lot of them aren't great, but that just creates noise or static. So how does someone find your movie? So going into all my projects, I just don't make a movie just because I want to make a movie. I make a movie because I know there's an audience. The reason why I jumped on for the Nickelodeon, because I knew there was an audience. I knew there was a nostalgia factor. I knew it's something that I related to and people my age range would relate to. So there's our audience. With Netflix, everyone knows what Netflix is. I don't have to, you know, tell you in a log line and explain what Netflix is or what streaming is or what it's built in. So if someone saw my movie, and that's why Netflix is in the title, it tells you what you're going to see. So going out and knowing where these audiences are and then making content that you find interesting, but for that audience, makes it a whole lot easier than going out to make a narrative film that's a drama about such and such with no actors. Now I have to sell you and I have to kind of explain why you want to see it and how it's different than other stuff. So you're already working at a disadvantage. And in the independent space where it's so hard to make profit, why do you want to start out at a disadvantage?
See, before you mentioned the Anne Frank film, the Anne Frank project you're working on, I actually was going to ask you if, like, you're niching nostalgia-based documentaries, because I knew The Office was coming. And The Office, what blows my mind, so I was young when The Office came out, and I remember The Office, and everyone was going crazy. My teenagers have binged through all of The Office, and they're rewatching it. I'm like, what the heck? What series can do that, or how many can do that? And I thought it was genius that you're making a documentary about The Office. But you're also straying into these other things. You know, the Anne Frank thing isn't going to have that nostalgia element.
Yeah, so the Anne Frank story came about as my wife was giving a TEDx talk. She's a clinical sports psychologist. Huh. And another person giving a talk at the same time talked about her being a pen pal of Otto Frank and all this. And I was like, well, for one, I thought he died. Like,
yeah.
I thought the whole Anne Frank family was wiped out.
Me too.
So I was like, here's another thing, just like with the Netflix doc, where I knew there was this story about how stupid Blockbuster was on not buying them. I was like, well, you know, I'm sure Europeans might know this, but in America, I don't think anyone knows that, like, someone actually survived to publish her diary. And so I kind of got into that story. And as a father, you know, thinking about the loss of not only your wife, but your, like, children are being murdered, like, it was just something that touched me. And I'm not Jewish. Like, I don't relate to it from the Jewish side, but right. I relate to it to the horrors of anyone. Like,
of course.
It just spoke to me as a father.
Yeah.
So that's why I jumped on that project. In The Office, the reason why I came up with The Office idea is because when I was making the Netflix doc, what was one of their top shows, it wasn't, you know, Stranger Things was up there, but it was like Friends in the Office when at the time I was making it, where like they're two top shows.
And yeah.
They didn't make those shows. So I was like, that's interesting. Like, I love The Office. I didn't watch Friends. So I went sort of the Office route.
Mm-hmm.
And I just discovered that, like, you know, like you said, like, young people love this show, a show that wasn't made for them, a show that nowadays you couldn't get on TV because everyone's like so afraid to make jokes. Like, Diversity Day is one of the best episodes of any show on TV. But nowadays, like, a studio would be terrified that they would be picketed if they made a show, even though it's making fun
right.
of that situation, they'd be too afraid to do it. So I think there's just so many aspects that are so so wrong that it's funny. It's fun to laugh.
Literally within the last year or so, my two teenage daughters, who are really cool and they're very woke and all that, they're like, Dad, come here. I go racing into the room and it's Diversity Day. They say, Dad, this is so wrong and so funny. they're like, have you seen this? I'm like, yeah, I've seen this.
I mean, the sheer part where Dwight's got the thing on his name and is like, and stereotypes might say that you're not a good driver. And he's like, oh, man, I'm a woman. Like, my wife will laugh at that, even though it's so wrong or whatever.
Right,
but everyone
right.
knows those stereotypes, and just laughing at, you know, the ridiculousness.
The ridiculous, right.
Is the fun that they had with that show. And I think people can really relate to it. And hopefully, I mean, I made it into a series because I was like, this is just too good just to be a documentary. And knowing the fan base, being part of the fan base, like, people love the binge. So I wanted to make something they could binge on.
That's great. You mentioned that a really important point when you're talking about using the iPhone. You said, you know, it's not really about the camera. It's not about the gear. It's about the story. And so I wanted to ask, I would imagine if you're making a drama, you're really going to have in your mind, like, you know, classic story structure, hero's journey, you know, all the things that they would teach you in film school about script writing. How much of that's in your head when you're making a documentary? Are you saying, like, oh, okay, Blockbuster is the villain and Netflix is the hero, and by the 30th minute of my documentary, I'm going to have to put some, you know, catalyzing event. Like, are you thinking story structure in a documentary, or is it more like, what is the facts? What's the story? Who are some of the more compelling people I'm interviewing? And let's kind of give a highlight reel.
I mean, most people think in linear purposes, like, oh, the company is founded and this is where they end up. But the thing is, to make it interesting, sometimes you have to, and I'm a big fan of Chris Nolan. And if you know Chris Nolan's movies, you know, Memento, like, changed how people, like, take
certainly didn't follow classic hero's journey.
Right. And Inception and, you know, with Tenet and everything like that. So that plays into me wanting to mess with the back and forth. But it's just not going with the obvious. Because if I went out and I made a movie that was like, Netflix started as Silicon Valley, they beat Blockbuster, and now they're like top streaming, is that really interesting? Am I just regurgitating information that people know? Or was Blockbuster actually onto something? Did Netflix, like, Netflix almost died a bunch of times, as you see in the documentary.
Right.
I mean, people think about, like, oh, Netflix had, like, the forward thinking to think about streaming. Well, streaming wasn't their goal. Their goal was you buy the movie and you download it. And the studios were so afraid about people copyright infringement and, like, stealing and then just bootlegging it, that they said, no, you cannot allow people to download it. And that's why streaming took off versus I can download my movie at home and watch it. Netflix, people think about, what was it? House of Cards, like, putting them on the map because it was such a bet. But they actually made a thing before that with, like, I don't know, like some Vegas singer or something. I forget who it was, but they did like a concert sort of thing that, like, bombed. So you never hear about a company's failures. It's always like they made the right decision here, right decision here. Like, for people that haven't seen the documentary, a company called Enron came to Blockbuster. They were both based in Texas and said, hey, we want to do box top sets that sends content directly to people's houses, which is basically Netflix. And Blockbuster's like, okay, we'll do a deal. But it was more of a shell of just more of the Enron's, like, fake technology to raise money. So it's like, yeah, Blockbuster made a right choice, but a wrong partner.
Yeah.
People don't know this, but Blockbuster was one of the financiers on Monster with Charlize Theron. Like, so they were already going sort of down that path of creating original content that they would have, right, like,
that's interesting,
exclusive. But then Netflix, I remember they had a wine, because they had a deal with the Weinstein Company where the Weinstein DVDs could only be rented at Blockbuster, but that would show up at Netflix anyway, because Netflix would go and purchase them and put them into the stream. So it's a thing of, like, it's not only about having the correct idea, because if you knew some of the back and forth, like, Blockbuster had some of these correct ideas also. It's just executing it correctly. So it's one thing to have the idea. It's another thing to execute.
When I think about, like, as you describe your process for making documentaries, making independent films, like, to me, you are an entrepreneur. Like, there's actually no difference. You're an entrepreneur in my mind. And I've been an entrepreneur for like 30 years. Do you see yourself as an entrepreneur? Or is it like, no, I'm an artist?
No, I see myself as a businessman. I mean, it's when I go to make films, like, I love film. Like, it makes me so sad that a lot of theaters are closing, or are people are out of work or things like that. But also I understand it's a business. Like, if I went out there and I told my wife I want to make a film and I kept making films that no one saw or didn't have any financial viability, like you only can do that so long. So you almost have to make films that are entertaining but actually can turn a profit so you can justify continuing to make your art in enjoyment. I mean, it brings me happiness sitting in front of a computer because I'm in the process of editing episode 5 of my office doc. And, you know, I spent like 2 hours working on a 2 to 3 minute piece of the movie or the docuseries, but that's fun.
Yeah.
Like you have to enjoy it. Even though it's a business, you still have to enjoy it. And that's one of those things that they say, like, you know, if you enjoy your work, you're never working.
Yeah, that's right. So I was going to, my final question is going to be, you know, what advice would you have for people who are in film school now or recently graduated? And you actually just gave great advice, I think, but thinking about, you know, more tactical advice for people who are, as you said, it's maybe easier than ever to become a filmmaker, but it also means a lot of people are trying to do it. And there's a lot of competition, a lot of noise. So, you know, what would you tell film school students today?
Well, when I was in film school, they had Robert Rodriguez, who graduated University of Texas, and he's a famous filmmaker. He did Sin City is what he's known for and a bunch of other films. And I had asked him like what his advice was, and it was kind of like, just go make your own stuff. And it was kind of like, at the time it was like, thanks, I was hoping you could give me. Yeah, but it's one of those things of like, no one searched me out and say, hey, guy that has experience in the industry but have never made a movie, I want you to make this movie, I want you to be able to direct. Like, no one's going to do that. So I had to do it myself. And the only way I will get my future projects is because I've actually done something. It's the catch 22. No one wants to hire a director that hasn't made anything. But then again, how are you supposed to make anything if no one will hire you? Well, the only other option you have is to go make your own stuff. And so that's the sort of thing of, and I actually run a YouTube channel called Screen Slam, and people will come up and ask about YouTube because we're 1.3 million subscribers, and they'll say, well, how'd you do it? And I'm like, well, you just fail a lot. Like, I've hit a lot of old videos, but if you go back and look at old videos, like, I suck. Like, I trouble, I have issues sometimes with, I was born tongue-tied, so I'll get tongue-tied or I'll get like mixed up, or when I used to have a teleprompter type stuff, like I'm dyslexic, so I'll read it backwards or stuff like that. But it's just things you power through, and over time you'll just get better. But the only way to get better is to actually do it. So it's the thing of, the hardest thing to do is, they normally say start, is actually finishing. Like, people will sit down and like, I'm going to write the next screenplay, right? And they get to page 10 and they just quit. The idea is to get the whole way through. And even if it's not good, you've actually finished stuff. And now the next time you can go back and figure out, this didn't work or that didn't work. But if you just start and stop, you're never going to get there. So that's what I would suggest, is like, just go do your own thing. And then, yeah, figure out why it didn't work. And in the end of the day, not everyone's going to make it. It's, I mean, yes, there's tons of content out there right now, but it's almost harder to make it now, because Netflix back in the day, we'll jump back to Netflix, they used to be a real they were a champion for independent film. They used to have the Red Envelope label, and they would go to Sundance and they would buy independent film. But now, to get on Netflix, you're going to have a deal with like Chris Hemsworth or a big type person for Amazing. Them to throw cash at you. And even if you do get on their platform, you only have a limited amount of time for people to see you before it's lost to just the mountain of content that's there. So, yeah, like I said, it's just, you got to go out and got to make your own stuff and not be afraid to fail.
No, that's great advice. And it, you know, I've written some books, have some author friends, and one of the more successful, novelist, independent novelist, makes a ton of money, writes a lot of books. he shocked me years ago and he said he never writes a second draft. I was asking about his writing process and he says, I just write forward and then I publish. I'm like, what? Like, what about the revisions and all that? And he said, that's for amateurs. He's like, you could spend forever revising. He's like, I know it's not perfect. I know where the mistakes are. I publish and I get better for the next one. But he's like, publish, get it out there, finish. And it's, yeah, it's one thing to start, far harder to actually have a body of work behind you. That of course just gets better with time.
Really, that's a great point. I mean, perfection will kill you. Like, you're never going to perfect something. So if your goal is for perfection, well, you just set your goal to an unattainable level.
Yeah.
So it's just right. The sort of thing of like, yeah, there's different things in the movie that I wish I could have tweaked this, or I wish I had footage for that, but I didn't want to go spend the money. I mean, while we were making the film, we were interviewing a franchisee he owned the Blockbusters in Alaska. And as we're doing the interview, he's like, yeah, we're going to close them in like 2 weeks. And I'm like, what? So I had to get on the phone and get someone over in Alaska to go shoot. I had to go find a shooter. So it's like one of those things of like, yeah, I would have loved to have flown out there and done a different thing, but you just get what you get. One of the issues that we had is I had a total of maybe 6 photos and 12 other photos, and the 12 photos were from like a Halloween party. So Reed Hastings is dressed as a criminal and other people are dressed as vampires, and it doesn't make sense in the movie. But then I have like 6 archival things for Netflix, and I have to make that last like an hour and 45 minutes, 6 photos. So
right.
Going out and figuring out how to tell the story without that aspect. And Mark Randolph says what he tells entrepreneurs now is document everything. And that's something they didn't do. So he says, go shoot photos, shoot videos of your company. Because if you make it, you're going to want that information. Like, you're not going to want to be like Netflix where there's no archival. I mean, this movie is the archival record.
Yeah.
They don't have like photos they could show back. Like, I have a photo of IPO day and a photo of like, when Mark and Reed and others went to New York to list, but it's like, I don't have that vault that started out holding all the DVDs and things like that. So I had to animate it or find stock. And it's just one of those things as a founder, which it should be easier for all the people that are out there creating their own businesses to think of themselves almost as a documentarian to capture all that and hold on to those assets.
Yeah, you know, and this is, again, it's fascinating on a film level, making a film, but also as an entrepreneur, you're talking about these assets. And something, as you're describing, that jumped out, I remembered from your movie, you do have a scene of, so they raised the $1.9 million or whatever it was to start the company. Now, if you've got a small business, you got a deli, your first customer hands you $1, $5, you usually grab it and you frame it and put it on your wall, like first customer, first dollar. Well, they framed the deposit ticket of that and you showed it. And I remembered it stood out to me. I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. Because Lead X, I started this one 4 years ago. And why didn't I save the deposit ticket? Why didn't I? And this idea of like, collecting mementos or artifacts of key moments. It's cool on a personal level, but it's cool for the future, you know, legacy of the company and all the people that come, you know, the employees or whoever, to sort of see that journey. I think a lot of us just don't think about it. We're in the grind and we don't think to pause to take that picture of the celebratory dinner or whatever it is that's, you know, meaningful in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, you have to think of these businesses as your babies, your children. And would you really want to turn back and say, I don't remember what my kids looked like when they were younger? That would be very sad. So you got to think of it the same way. If you care, you want your story to go on past you.
Yeah, that's incredible.
The coolest aspect is, you know, back like when I'm long and gone, I mean, hopefully Netflix will still be around or some people will study in history books. But if they ever want to go back and see that history, at least now I've created something that will live on past me. So it's a little way to have immortality.
It's a big way. Yeah, I think it's a big way. Sean Coffin, the producer-director of course, Netflix versus the World. I saw it on Amazon Prime. I love it. TexasMovieDirector.com is your website. I sure hope you put some director cut clips up on that website soon for us junkies who want more. Twitter handle, Dude versus Movie, Dude vs. Movie. You mentioned YouTube channel. Is it Screen Slam?
Yeah, it's Screen Slam. It's my days of doing Hollywood interviews and red carpets and stuff like that. So I still run it with partners back in L.A.
Screen Slam. Any other places we should send our listeners and our readers?
I would say that if people go and they watch the movie on Amazon, like, it's helpful if you leave a review, because Amazon has a thing called CER, and it's how they calculate what they pay per hour watched. So Netflix, Amazon used to pay 15 cents an hour, which actually could turn into a good profit. But now they've dropped it where if you're below 50%, they give you a penny, because they're trying to get rid of all that undesirable content. Mm. So the more reviews you have, the more that Amazon sees that people are enjoying it, the higher they'll pay you. So
you just stumbled on gold here. So I had no idea how that worked. So you can get your movie on Amazon. Doesn't mean they've paid you anything. They're only going to pay you per viewed hour.
Right. When you're on Prime.
When you're on Prime. And it's like roughly 15 cents per viewed hour.
That's where it used to be. They dropped it. Now you can – I think the average, you can get anywhere from 12 to one penny. So if you're getting 12, you're doing decent.
Yeah.
You're doing well, but that's only like the top of the top.
Yeah.
But they have this rating. So if you're below 50%, you're only getting a penny. So your goal is to be above 50% CER, and then it fluctuates based on that if you're making 5 cents, 7 cents, 10 cents. An hour watch. But that just tells, for the filmmakers out there, that tells you how long your movie has to be watched by people around the world. Because you can do the math, and if you're only making, you know, 5 cents an hour, you need a lot of hours to actually make any decent profit.
Yeah, I can relate and commiserate, because so I write for Forbes.com, you know, I put my articles on Forbes.com, and it's some ridiculous, you know, like 1/10 of one penny. So a tenth of a cent per article read. But then there's all these other hoops. Like, you have to do 5 articles or they won't pay you anything. And they only count views in the 30 days. So like, I've got some 25 million viewed articles that I make no money on because I wrote them 7 years ago for them. You know, so there's all these things. Tough to make a living at a tenth of a cent per reader, you know, kind of thing. So it's the publisher. Yeah. I mean, it's not easy to be a publisher, but it's even harder to be the one creating the content for the publishers. So that's good. Sean, thanks again. Fantastic movie. And, you know, trust me, I make friends for life. So not only will I continue to beat the drum for Netflix versus the World, but I can't wait for your docuseries on The Office to come out, and I'm sure my kids are going to be excited too.
Oh, I can't wait for people to see it. My goal is to work out a deal with Peacock, because I think that would be the perfect platform for it. But if not, I'll put it back on Amazon Prime. Like, I think the audience will find it. So I tell you what, I'll even send you the first episode, which is done.
Oh, this just made all this worthwhile. That sounds good. Sean, thanks for the time today.
Thank you so much.